He says so. It would have been ghastly, Isola broke in, riding behind a banished man. How can you even think of it? It's the shame. No one would even take you in.
It would have been their loss, not ours.
Rother sighed and ran her needle into her embroidery. And what about when he got you with child?
Gowrion never would have let our child starve. You don't understand. I should have gone with him. It would have been all right. I just know it would have been.
Now, Gwenny Lamb, you're just not thinking clearly, Rother said.
As clearly as I need to,
Bronwyn snapped.
Oh, my pardons, my lady, but you don't understand. I know I should have gone.
Both her friends stared, eyes narrow in honest concern.
They think I'm daft, Bronwyn thought, and maybe I am, but I know it.
Well, there are a lot of men in the kingdom, Isola said, in an obvious attempt to be helpful.
I'll wager you won't have any trouble getting another one.
I'll wager he's better than Gowrion, too.
He must have done something awful to get himself exiled.
At court, a man has to do very little to get himself out of favour, Rother said. There are plenty of others to do it for him. Now here, Lamb, I won't have Gowrion spoken ill of in my hall. He may have failed, but truly, Gwenny, he tried to spare you this. He let me know that he saw trouble coming, and he was hoping he'd have time to release you from the betrothal before the blow fell. She shook her head sadly. The king is a very stubborn man.
I can't believe that, Bronwyn snapped. He never would have cast me off to my shame. I know he loves me. I don't care what you say.
Of course he loved you, child, Rother said patiently. That's what I've just been saying. He wanted to release you in such a way as to spare you the slightest hint of shame. When he failed, he planned to take you with him.
If it weren't for Garrow, Bronwyn said.
Rother and Isola glanced at each other, their eyes meeting in silent conference. This argument had come full circle again, in its tediously predictable way. Bronwyn looked out the window at the apple trees and wondered why everything in life seemed tedious. Bronwyn and Geraint were visiting at the Boar's Dun for a few days, and Bronwyn knew that Geraint had arranged the visit for her sake. That night at dinner, she watched her brother as he sat across the table and shared a trencher with Isola.
He still has his betrothed, Bronwyn thought bitterly.
It would have been a wonderful release to hate him, but she knew that he had done only what he thought best for her, whether it truly was best or not. Her beloved brother. While their parents and uncles always doted on Geraint, the precious son and heir, they had mostly ignored Bronwyn, the unnecessary daughter. Geraint himself, however, had loved her, played with her, helped care for her, and led her round with him in a way that was surprising for a lad. She remembered him explaining how to straighten an arrow, or build a toy dun with stones, and he was always dragging her out of danger, away from a fierce dog, away from the river's edge, and now, away from a man he considered unworthy of her. All through the meal, Geraint would sometimes look up, catch her looking at him, and give her a timid smile. Eventually, Bronwyn could no longer bear the crowded hall, and made her escape into the cool twilight of Rother's garden. Red as drops of blood, the roses bloomed thickly. She picked one, cradled it in her hand, and remembered Gowrion telling her that she was his one true rose.
"My lady, are you distressed about summat?"
It was Blaine, hurrying across the garden. Bronwyn knew perfectly well that he was in love with her. Every soft look, every longing smile that he gave her, stabbed her like a knife.
"How can I not be distressed, my lord?"
"Well, true spoken, but every dark time comes to an end."
"My lord, I doubt if the dark will ever end for me."
"Oh, here, things are never as bad as all that."
As shy as a young lad, Blaine smiled at her. Bronwyn wondered why she was even bothering to fight. Sooner or later, Geraint would hand her over to his blood-sworn friend, whether she wanted to marry him or not.
"My lord is very kind. I hardly know what I say these days."
Blaine picked another rose and held it out. Rather than be rude, Bronwyn took it.
"Let me be blunt, my lady," Blaine said. "You must know that my heart aches to marry you, but I understand what you say about your dark time. Will you think of me this time next year, when these roses are blooming again? That's all I ask of you.
I will then, if we both live.
Blaine looked up sharply, caught by her words, even though it was only an empty phrase, a pious acknowledgement that the gods are stronger than men. As Bronwyn groped for something to say to dispel the chill around them, Geraint came out into the garden.
"Making sure that I'm treating your sister honourably," Blaine said with a grin.
"Oh, I've no doubt you'd always be honourable. I was just wondering what happened to Gwenny."
Geraint escorted her back to the women's hall. Since Rotha and Isola were still at table, Bronwyn allowed him to come in with her. He perched uneasily on the edge of the open window while a servant lit the candles in the sconces with a taper. After the servant left, they were alone, face to face with each other in the silent room. Restlessly, Bronwyn turned away and saw a moth fluttering dangerously close to a candle flame. She caught it softly in cupped hands and set it free at the window.
"You've got the softest heart in the world," Geraint said.
"Well, the poor things are too stupid to know better."
Geraint caught both her hands in his.
"Gwenny, do you hate me?"
"I could never hate you. Never."
For a moment, Bronwyn thought that he would weep.
"I know that marriage means everything to a lass, but we'll find you a better man than an exile. Has Blaine declared himself to you?"
"He has, but please, I can't bear thinking of marrying anyone right now."
"Gwenny, I'll make you a solemn promise. Head of our clan or not, I'll never make you marry until you truly want to."
Bronwyn threw her arms around his neck and wept against his shoulder. As he stroked her hair, she felt him trembling against her.
"Take me home, Garrow. Please, I want to go home."
"Well then, that's what we'll do."
Yet once they were back in the Falcon Dun, Bronwyn bitterly regretted leaving Rotha and Isola's company. Everything she saw at home reminded her either of her father or her prince, both irrevocably gone. Up in her bedchamber she had a wooden box filled with courting gifts from Galrion, brooches, rings, and a silver goblet with her name inscribed on it. He would have had his name put next to hers once they were married. Although she couldn't read, Bronwyn would at times take out the goblet and weep as she traced the writing with her fingertip. The dailiness of her life eventually drew her back from her despair. Bronwyn had the servants to supervise, the chamberlain to consult, the household spinning and sewing to oversee and to take up herself. She and her serving woman, Luther, spent long afternoons working on the household clothes and taking turns singing old songs and ballads to each other. Soon, as well, she had a new worry in Geraint. Often she caught him weeping on their father's grave, and in the evenings he turned oddly silent. As he sat in his father's chair, his chair now, he drank steadily and watched the flames playing in the fireplace. Although Bronwyn sat beside him out of sisterly duty, he rarely spoke more than two words at a time. On a day when Geraint was hunting, Gwerbret Madoc came for a visit with six men of his warband for an escort. As she curtsied to the Gwerbret, Bronwyn noticed the men staring at her, sly eyes, little half-smiles, an undisguised lust that she had seen a thousand times on the faces of men. She hated them for it.
"Greetings, my lady," Madoc said. "I've come to pay my respects to your father's grave."
After sending the servants to care for his men, Bronwyn took Madoc into the hall and poured him ale with her own hands, then sat across from him at the honour table. Madoc pledged her with the tankard.
"My thanks, Bronwyn. Truly, I wanted to see how you fared."
"As well as I can, Your Grace."
"And your brother?"
"He's still mourning our father. I can only hope he'll put his grief away soon."
Bronwyn saw that he was truly worried, not merely being courteous, and his worry made her own flare.
"Garrow hasn't been himself of late. I don't know what's wrong."
"Ah, I wondered. Well, here, you know that your brother and yourself are under my protection. If ever you need my aid, you send a page to me straight away. That's no idle courtesy either. Sometimes when a man gets to brooding, he's a bit much for his sister to handle. So send me a message and I'll ride by to cheer Garrow up a bit."
"Oh, my thanks. Truly, my thanks. That gladdens my heart, Your Grace.
Soon Geraint rode in from hunting, bringing a doe for the cook to clean and hang. Since the two men had important matters to discuss, Bronwyn withdrew and went outside to look for Lothar. Out by the wall, Brithu was helping the cook dress the deer. They'd cut off the head and thrown it to the pack of dogs, who were growling and worrying it. Although she'd grown up seeing game cleaned, Bronwyn felt sick. The velvet eyes looked up at her, then a dog dragged it away. Bronwyn turned and ran back to the broch. On the morrow, Madoc took leave of them early. As Bronwyn and Geraint were eating their noon meal, Geraint told her a bit about his Grace's talk. It looked as if there might be trouble out on the western border, where a few clans still grumbled at the king's rule.
"I'd hate to see you ride to another war so soon," Bronwyn said.
"Why?"
"You're all I have in the world."
Suddenly thoughtful, Geraint nodded, then cut up a bit of the roast fowl on their trencher with his dagger. He picked up a tidbit and fed it to her with his fingers.
"Well, little sister, I try to be mindful of my duty to you."
Although it was pleasantly said, Bronwyn suddenly felt a cold chill down her back, as if something was trying to warn her of danger. Yet when the danger finally came, she had no warning at all. On a sunny afternoon, they rode out together into the wild meadowlands to the east, a vast stretch of rolling hills that neither the falcon nor the boar had men enough to till or defend. At a little stream, they stopped to water their horses. When they were children, this stream had marked the limit of the land they were allowed to ride without an adult along. It was odd to think that now. When she could have ridden as far as she wanted, she had no desire to wander away from home. While Geraint tended the horses, Bronwyn sat down in the grass and looked for daisies, but she couldn't bear to pluck those innocent symbols of a lass's first love. She'd had her love, and lost him, and she doubted if she'd ever find another. Not merely a husband, but a love. Eventually, Geraint sat down beside her.
"Going to make a daisy chain?" he remarked.
"I'm not. It's too late for things like that."
Geraint looked sharply away.
"Gwenny, there's something I'd best ask you. It aches my heart to pry, but it's going to matter some day if I have to bargain out your betrothal."
Bronwyn knew perfectly well what was on his mind.
"I didn't bet him. Don't trouble your heart over it for a minute."
Geraint smiled in such a fierce, gloating relief that all at once she saw him as the falcon, poised, hovering on the wind, seemingly motionless, although it fights to keep its place. Then he struck, catching her by the shoulders and kissing her before she could shove him away.
"Kero!"
Although Bronwyn tried to twist free, he was far too strong for her. He held her tight, kissed her, then pinned her down in the grass to give her a long, greedy kiss that set her heart pounding only partly in fear. All at once, as silently as he'd caught her, he let her go and sat back on the grass, with tears running down his face. Her shoulders ached from those greedy hands, her brother's hands, as she sat up, watching him warily. Geraint pulled his dagger and handed it to her, hilt first.
"Take it and slit my throat. I'll kneel here and let you do it."
"Never."
"Then I'll do it myself. Go home. Get Luther and ride to Madoc. By the time he rides back, I'll be dead."
Bronwyn felt as if she were a bit of wire, being pulled between a jeweler's tools until it's as fine as a single hair. This last loss was too much to bear. Her brother, her beloved brother, kneeling before her as a supplicant. If he did kill himself, no one would know the truth of it, thinking him mad over his mourning, not an unclean man who'd broken the laws of the gods. But she would know, and she would never see him again. The wire was being pulled tighter and tighter.
"Will you forgive me before I die?"
Geraint said. She wanted to speak, but no words came. When he misread her silence, his eyes filled with tears.
"Done, then. It was too much to hope for."
The wire broke. In a rush of tears, Bronwyn flung herself against him.
"Gero, Gero, Gero, you can't die."
Geraint dropped the dagger and slowly, hesitantly, put his hands on her waist, as if to shove her away, then clasped her tight in his arms.
"Gero, please, live for my sake.
How can I? What shall I do? Live hating my blood-sworn friend if you marry Blaine? Every time you looked at me, I'd know you were remembering my fault.
But the clan... If you die, the clan dies with you. Oh, by the goddess of the moon. If you kill yourself, I might as well do the same. What else would be left for me?
He held her a little ways away from him, and as they looked into each other's eyes, she felt death standing beside her, a palpable presence.
Does my maidenhead mean so much to you?
Geraint shrugged, refusing to answer.
Then you might as well take it. You wouldn't force me for it, so I'll give it to you.
He stared at her like a drunken man. Bronwyn wondered why he couldn't see what was so clear to her. If they were doomed, they might as well live an hour longer in each other's arms. She put her hands alongside his face and pulled him down to kiss her. His hands dug into her shoulders so tightly that it hurt, but she let him kiss her again. As his passion for her flared, it was frightening, wrapping her round, catching her up like a branch in a fire. When she let herself go limp in his arms, Bronwyn felt more like a priestess in a rite than a lover. She felt nothing but the force of him, the solid weight of him, her mind so far away that she felt she was watching their lovemaking in a dream. When they finished, he lay next to her and pillowed his head on her naked breasts, his mouth moving on her skin, a gentle, nuzzling kiss of gratitude. She ran her fingers through his hair and thought of the dagger lying ready for them.
I never wanted to die a maid, she thought, and who better than Garrow?
He raised his head and smiled at her, a soft, drunken smile of pleasure and love.
Are you going to kill me now? Bronwyn said.
Why? Not yet, my love. Not after this. There'll be time enough later for the pair of us to die. I know we will, and the gods know it too, and that's enough for them. We'll have our summer first.
Bronwyn looked up at the sky, a pure blue, glittering like a fiery reproach from the gods. Her hand groped for the dagger.
Not yet.
Geraint caught her wrist, those heavy calloused hands circling it, mastering her, grabbing the dagger away. He sat up and threw it. It glittered through the air and plunged into the stream. Bronwyn thought of protesting, but his beauty caught her, a cruel flaming beauty like the angry sun. He ran his hand down her body, then lay down beside her and kissed her. This time she felt her desire rise to match his, a bittersweet lust born of despair. When they rode home that evening, Bronwyn was surprised that everyone treated them so normally and easily. She was expecting that everyone would see, if not their dishonour, then at least their coming death, as if death should cast a glow around them that could be seen for miles. But Brithu merely took their horses and bowed. The Chamberlain came hurrying over to Geraint with some tedious news from the village. Luther met Bronwyn and asked if she should set the kitchen maid to laying the table. The evening turned so normal that Bronwyn wanted to scream. After the meal, the servants settled in at their hearth, and Geraint, with a tankard in his hand, at his. The great hall was dark except for the crossed and battling glows from the two small fires. Bronwyn watched her brother's shadowed face and wondered if he was happy. She hardly knew what she felt. For the past year she'd been readying herself for marriage, when she would swear an oath to her husband and bind herself under his will. Instead, she'd sworn a blood oath, giving up her will to a pledge of death. There was nothing left but to center herself on Geraint, her first man, her brother, just as she'd planned to do with her prince. Until she let Geraint slit her throat, she would serve him as her lord. The decision gave her a precarious peace, as if she had closed a door in her mind on the tragedy of the past. Galrion was gone, and all the promise he'd held out of a different kind of life.
Garrow, what are you thinking about?
That rebellion. If there's a war this summer, I won't go. I promise you that. I'll find a way out.
Bronwyn smiled, her heart bursting with love. He was making the biggest sacrifice a man like him could, giving up his glory to live with her in the summer and die with her in the fall. Bronwyn would have liked to have slept in his bed, as was her place, but it was, of course, far too risky with so many servants in the dun. If the priests in the village ever learned of their evil, they would come to tear them apart. Often, over the next few weeks, they rode out together to lie down in the soft grass. Wrapped in his arms, Bronwyn could think of Geraint as her husband. Her calm continued, as fair as the weather, summer day after summer day slipping by, like water in a full stream, silent, smooth as glass, glistening. Nothing could disturb her calm, not even her occasional thought of Isolde, whose betrothed she had taken away. At first it seemed that Geraint too was happy, but slowly his brooding and his rages returned. Geraint was growing more and more like their father, dark as a storm when he was idle, glowering into the fire and pacing restlessly around the ward. One evening, when Brithu brought him ale, the lad slipped and spilled it. Geraint swung and slapped him so hard that the lad fell to his knees.
"You clumsy little bastard!"
As the lad cowered back, Geraint's hand went to his dagger almost of its own will. Bronwyn threw herself in between them.
"Hold your hand, Gero! You'll be weeping with remorse not 5 minutes later if you hurt the lad."
Sobbing, Brithu fled the hall. Bronwyn saw the rest of the servants watching with pale faces and terrified eyes. She grabbed Geraint by the shoulders and shook him hard.
"Oh, by the hells," Geraint said. "My thanks."
Bronwyn fetched him more ale herself, then went out to the stable where, as she expected, she found Brithu weeping in the hayloft. She hung her candle lantern on a nail in the wall, then sat down and laid a gentle hand on his shoulder. He was only 12, a skinny little thing for his age.
"Here, here," Bronwyn said. "Let me have a look."
Brithu wiped the tears away on his sleeve and turned his face up to her. An ugly red puff was swelling on his cheek, but his eye was unharmed.
"Lord Geraint's sorry already. He won't do this again." "My thanks, my lady,"
Brithu stammered.
"What's so wrong with Lord Geraint these days?"
"He's half mad from mourning his father, that's all." Brithu considered, touching the swelling on his cheek.
"He would have killed me if it wasn't for you. If ever you want me to do anything for you, I swear I will."
Late that night, when everyone was asleep, Bronwyn crept out of her chamber and went to Geraint, who was sleeping in their father's room and in their father's bed. The great carved bedstead with embroidered hangings, marked with falcons, and the privilege of the head of the clan. She slipped in beside him, kissed him awake, and let him take her for the sake of peace in the house. Afterward, when he lay drowsy in her arms, every muscle at ease, she felt for the first time the one power allowed to her as a woman, to use her beauty and her body to bring her man to the place where he would listen to her instead of only to his whims.
"It would have been different with my prince," she thought.
Tears ran down her cheeks, mercifully hidden from her brother by the darkness. Though Bronwyn was careful to leave his bed and return to her own, that next morning she had her first intimation that the rest of the household was beginning to suspect. The men seemed utterly unaware, but at times Bronwyn caught Luther watching her with a frightened wondering in her eyes. Bronwyn took Geraint aside and told him to go hunting and leave her alone. Over the next few days he ignored her for long hours at a time, going hunting or riding round the domain. He even began talking of visiting Madoc or Blaine. But always she felt him watching her whenever they were in the same room, as if he were guarding her like a treasure. Although she tried to put him off, finally he insisted that she ride with him into the hills. That afternoon they found a copse of willows for their love-making. She had never seen him so passionate, making love to her as if every time he had her made him want her more rather than satisfying him. Afterward, he fell asleep in her arms. She stroked his hair and held him, but she felt weary, so tired that she wanted to sink into the earth and never see the sky again. When Geraint woke, he sat up, stretching, smiling at her. Beside him, tangled in his clothes, lay his dagger.
"Gero, kill me now."
"I won't. Not yet."
All at once Bronwyn knew it was time to die, that they had to die now, this very afternoon. She sat up and grabbed his arm.
"Kill me now. I beg you."
Geraint slapped her across the face, the first blow he'd ever given her. When she began to cry, he flung his arms around her, kissed her, and begged her to forgive him. She did forgive him, simply because she had no choice. He was more than her whole life. He was her death as well. All during the ride home, she felt the urgency ache her. They should be dead. When they rode into the ward, she saw horses tied up outside. Lord Blaine had come to visit. Blaine stayed for 3 days, hunting with Geraint, while Bronwyn crept around and tried to avoid them both. Only once did she have to talk with Blaine alone, and then he held to his pledge and said not one word about marriage. On his last night there, however, he begged her to stay at the table after dinner. Geraint brooded, staring into the fire and drinking as steadily as if he'd forgotten they had a guest. When Blaine started talking to Bronwyn about his mother, she could only listen miserably, hardly able to answer, because she was wondering what Rother would say when she learned the truth. Apparently, Blaine misread her silence.
"Now here, my lady," Blaine said. "I promise you that I'd never even speak of marriage till the spring, and I keep my word." "What's this?"
Geraint swiveled round in his chair.
"I've spoken to you before about paying court to your sister."
"So you have," Geraint said, smiling. "I've made her a promise, you see. I told her that I'd never make her marry unless she chooses to."
"Indeed. Even if she stays under your roof all her life?"
"Just that."
Blaine hesitated, his eyes darkening.
"Well, my lady," he said to Bronwyn, "you're lucky in your brother, aren't you?"
"I think so. I honour him."
Blaine smiled, but all at once Bronwyn was frightened. The glow from the smoky fire danced, but it seemed to her that the fire came from Geraint, as if long tendrils of flame were reaching out for Blaine against all their wills. With summer at its height, the sun lay hot along the dusty road, its light as gold as the grain ripening in the fields. Nevin, who had once been Prince Galrion, led a pack mule laden with baled herbs across the border of the Falcon Lands. As he walked, he kept a constant lookout for Geraint, who might well be out riding his roads. Nevin doubted if anyone else would recognize the prince in this dusty peddler with his shabby clothes, shaggy hair, and old mule. He was learning that a man could be invisible without mighty Dwayoma workings, merely by acting in unexpected ways in unexpected places. No one would expect the prince to dare come near the Falcon again. When he came to the village, Nevin even risked buying a tankard of ale from the tavern man, who barely glanced his way after he'd taken his copper. Nevin sat in the corner near an old woman and asked her foolish questions about the countryside, as if he'd travelled from far away. When he left, no one even noticed him go. It was toward evening when he reached his destination, a wooden hut on the edge of the wild forest. Out in front, two goats were grazing on the scrubby grass, while Ina sat on her stoop and watched them. An old woman, thin as a stick, with long twig-like fingers, gnarled from her long years of hard work. Her white hair was carelessly caught up in a dirty scarf. A herb woman and midwife, she was thought by some folk to be a witch, but in truth she merely loved her solitude.
"Good morrow, lad," Ina said. "Looks like old Rhaegar sent me a pretty thing or two."
"He has. This supply should last you through the winter."
Nevin unloaded the mule and carried the herbs inside, then watered the animal and sent it out to graze with the goats. He came back to the hut to find Ina laying bread and cheese on her small unsteady table. When she handed him a wooden cup of water and told him to set to, Nevin dug in, spreading the soft, pungent goat's cheese on the dark bread. Ina nibbled a bit of bread and studied him so curiously that Nevin wondered if she knew he'd once been the prince.
"It's wearisome having old Rhaegar gone from this part of the forest," Ina said. "And so sudden it was, him coming by one day to tell me he was going. Has he ever told you why?"
"Well, good dame, I do what my master says and hold my tongue."
"Always best with a strange one like our Rhaegar. Well, if he sends you to me with herbs every now and then, I'll manage."
Ina cut a few more slices from the loaf and laid them on Nevin's plate.
"I miss Rhaegar, though. I could always count on his counsel-like when there was some troubling thing."
Nevin felt the Dwayoma warning down his back.
And how fares Lord Geraint these days?
You're almost as sharp as your master, aren't you, lad? Well, here, tell Rhaegar this tale for me. He always kept an eye like on poor little Bronwyn.
Did he now? I never knew that.
Oh, truly he did, just from a fatherly distance, like. So tell him about this. About a month ago it was, the page up at the Dun got a bit of a fever, and a stubborn thing it was. I must have been back there 5 times before the lad was right again. And Lord Geraint gives me a joint of venison for it. He says, "Do you have a herb to take madness away, Ina?" He was jesting, I suppose, but he smiled so cold-like it troubled my heart. And then, the last time I went up the hill, I see Geraint sobbing on his father's grave.
You can rest assured I'll tell Rhaegar about it. How does Bronwyn fare, shut up with a man like that?
Now there's the strangest thing of all. You think she'd be heartsick, but she goes around like a woman in a dream. I've never seen the lass look so broody-like. I'd say she was with child, but whose would it be? She's just as broody as if her belly was swelling, but that betrothed of hers has been gone too long now. Well, tell Rhaegar for me.
On the ride home, Nevin pushed the bulky mule as fast as it would go, but it still took him over 2 days to reach his new home. Up in the wild forest north of the Boar's Domain, Nevin and Rhaegar had cleared a good space of land near a creek. They'd used the logs to build a rough house and the land to plant beans, turnips and such like. Since Rhaegar's reputation as a healer moved north with him, they had plenty of food and even a few coins, since farmers and bondsmen alike were willing to pay with chickens and cheese for Rhaegar's herbs. Now, when it was too late, Nevin clearly saw that he and Bronwyn would have had a comfortable, if spare, life in the forest.
"If only you hadn't been such a dolt," Nevin cursed himself. "Such a stupid fool."
Rhaegar was out in the front of the house, treating the running eye of her little boy while the mother squatted nearby. From her ragged brown tunic, Nevin saw that she was a bondwoman, her thin face utterly blank, as if she hardly cared whether the lad was cured or not, even though she'd brought him all this way. On her face was her brand, the old scar pale on dirty skin. Though he was barely 3, the lad was already branded too, marked out as Lord Blaine's property for the rest of his life. Rhaegar stood the lad on a tree stump and wiped the infected eye with a bit of rag dipped in herbal salve. Nevin went to stable the mule alongside the bay gelding. When he came back, the bondswoman looked at him with feigned disinterest. Even from 10 feet away he could smell her unwashed flesh and rags. Rhaegar called her over, gave her a pot of salve, and told her how to apply it. She listened, her face showing a brief flicker of hope.
"I can't pay you much, my lord," she said. "I brought some of the first apples. You and the lad eat those on your way home." "My thanks."
She stared at the ground.
"I heard you tended poor folk, but I didn't believe it at first."
"It's true. Spread the tale around."
"I was so frightened,"
she went on, staring at the ground.
"If the lad went blind, they'd kill him because he couldn't work."
"What?" Nevin broke in. "Lord Blaine would never do such a thing."
"Lord Blaine?"
She looked up with a faint smile.
"Well, so he wouldn't. How would he even know we're alive to be killed? His overseer, my lord, that's who'd do it."
Nevin supposed that she spoke the cold truth. As the prince, he'd given less thought to bondmen than to horses. Rhaegar was making him see a different world. Once the woman went on her way, Rhaegar and Nevin went inside their cabin, a single light airy room, scented with new-cut pine. They had a scattering of cast-off furniture from grateful farmers, a table, a bench, a freestanding cabinet to hold cookware. On one wall was the half-finished hearth Nevin was building as his share of the summer's work. Nevin dipped the ale from a barrel, then brought the dented tankards over to join Rhaegar at the table.
"And how was the journey?" Rhaegar said. "How fares old Ina?"
Well enough, my lord. But she told me a strange tale about the falcon. Ah, ye gods, my poor Bronwyn. I truly wish you'd done what my father would have, beaten me half to death for my fault.
That would have solved nothing and made you feel like you'd made amends when you hadn't.
Rhaegar hesitated on the edge of anger.
Ah, well, what's past is past. Tell me the tale.
While Nevin told him, Rhaegar listened quietly, but his hands clasped his tankard tighter and tighter. At the end, Rhaegar swore under his breath.
Truly, we'd best look into this. Here, old Ina can practically smell when a lass is with child. There's no chance the babe's yours, is it?
Not unless longing for a woman can get her with child.
His eyes still dark, Rhaegar smiled.
And what will you think of your Gwenny, if she's big with another man's child?
If he's a good man, let her go with him. If he's not, then I'll take her, child and all.
Well and good. First we'll have to see if that child's Blaine's. If it is, there'll be a wedding, and that'll be the end to it. If not, I still have hope we can get her away.
Here, my lord, why are you so concerned with Bronwyn? Is it just the honour of the thing?
No, that I can't tell you just yet.
Nevin waited, hoping for at least a word more, but Rhaegar merely looked away, thinking.
I'll ride down to the boar early tomorrow, Rhaegar said at length. Out of courtesy, I should let Lady Rother know there's a herbman nearby. You stay here. Blaine would hate to kill you if he saw you, but his honour would make him do what the king ordered. I should reach the dun by noon, so you might make yourself a fire and see if you can follow me that way.
On the morrow, Nevin spent an impatient morning digging stones out of their little field for the hearth. So far, most of his training was just this sort of menial labour in the summer heat. Often it galled him. What was a prince doing, sweating like a flea-bitten bondman? Yet in his heart, he knew that humbling the prince's pride was the real work.
There is only one key to unlock the secrets of the Dwayoma. I want to know in order to help the world. Anyone wanting power for its own sake gets only dribs and drabs, hard won, harder to keep, and not worth having.
Yet, here and there, Rhaegar had given Nevin work bearing more directly on Dwayoma lore. Although Nevin had always had the second sight, it came and went of its own will, showing him what it chose to show and not a jot more. Now he was learning to bring the sight under his will. Nevin made a circle of stones outside on the ground and built a small fire, which he lit like any other man with a tinderbox and flint. He let the fire burn down until the logs were glowing caves of coals. Then he stretched out on the ground, pillowed his chin on his hands, and stared directly into the fire caves. He slowed his breathing to the right rhythm and thought of Rhaegar. At last, the fire cave stretched, widened, and turned into the sheen of sunlight glowing on a polished wood chamber. In the flames he made out Rhaegar, a tiny image. Nevin summoned his will and thought of Rhaegar, imaged him clearly, and forced his mind to him. The vision swelled, turned solid, swelled again, and became as clear as though Nevin were looking into the women's hall from an outside window. With one last effort of will, Nevin went in, hearing a little rushy hiss, a dropping sensation in his stomach, and at last he was standing beside Rhaegar on the floor. Lady Rother was sitting on her chair, with Isola perching on a footstool nearby. With his shirt off to reveal a bad case of boils, a page was kneeling in front of Rhaegar on the floor.
"These will have to be lanced," Rhaegar said. "Since I don't have my tools with me, I'll have to ride back tomorrow with your lady's leave."
The boy gave a miserable squeak in anticipation. "Now don't be a silly lad," Rother said. "They've been hurting you for weeks, and if the herdman lances them, they'll be over and done with. Don't you go hiding in the forest all day tomorrow." The lad grabbed his shirt from the floor, made Rother a bow, then fled unceremoniously. Smiling, Rother shook her head at him, then motioned Rhaegar to a chair next to hers.
"Sit down and rest, good sir," Rother said.
So, you say you're from the south. Have you any interesting news?
My thanks.
Rego bowed and took the chair.
Well, no true news, but a fair bit of evil rumour.
Indeed, Rother said unsteadily. How fares Lord Geraint of the Falcon?
I see the rumours have reached my lady's ears. Badly, alas, and of course the locals insist on talking of witchcraft.
Isola leaned forward, clasping her arms around her knees, her eyes half filled with tears. When he remembered the happy night of her betrothal, Nevin felt such a stab of pity for her that the vision broke. It took him a long time to retrieve it.
Mourning is understandable, Rego was saying. But after all, the natural order of things is for the son to lose his father sooner or later.
He glanced at Isola.
Once he has you at his side, no doubt the black mood will lift.
If he ever marries me,
Isola burst out.
Hold your tongue, lamb, Rother said.
How can I?
Isola snapped. After what Blaine said.
Rother raised her hand as if to slap her. Isola fell silent.
Kindly forgive my daughter, good sir, Rother said. She's worrying her heart, thinking that what happened to poor Bronwyn might happen to her.
A sad, sad thing that was.
Rega sighed.
Let's hope she finds a better man soon. The villagers tell me that your son hopes to announce his betrothal to the lady.
Well, Rother's voice went flat. I'll pray that such happens.
So, Nevin thought, that babe's not Blaine's.
True enough, Rega answered. I'd hoped so much it was.
Nevin was so shocked that he lost the vision again, and for good this time.
Rega returned at sunset. He tended the mule, then came into the hut where Nevin, steaming with curiosity, was laying out their evening meal.
Rega took a silver coin out of his brigger pocket and tossed it onto the table.
Our Lady Rotha is generous, Rega remarked. Little does she know whom this will feed, but she'd be glad. We talked a bit more after you left us, and she still honours you, Prince Gowrion.
The prince is dead.
Rega smiled and sat down, picking up a slice of bread and butter.
I think I'll risk getting Nevin's throat cut tomorrow. Lord Blaine will be at the hunt when I ride back to tend that lad's boils, so you can come with me.
Well and good, my lord. Here, why did you wish that child was Blaine's?
Think, lad. If Blaine's not to blame, well then who is? What men live in the Falcon's Dun? A couple of 12-year-old lads, a grubby stableman, and the old chamberlain, so aged that he can barely lift his hand to a maid, much less anything else. So who does that leave?
Well, nobody.
Nobody?
Oh, by the hells.
Nevin could barely say it.
Geraint.
By the hells, indeed. This is a terrible dark thing to accuse any man of doing, and I won't make a move until I'm sure.
Nevin picked up the table dagger, twisting it in his fingers for the solid comfort of the metal.
If it's true, Nevin said, I'll kill him.
Look at you, your father's son indeed.
Nevin stabbed the dagger hard into the tabletop and let it quiver.
And would killing him be such a wrong thing?
It would, for you.
Rega took a calm bite of bread and butter.
I forbid you to even think about it.
Done, then. His blood is safe from me.
Rega considered him carefully. Nevin picked up a slice of bread, then flung it back onto the plate.
You said you'd take her, child and all, Rega said. Is that still true if she's carrying her own brother's bastard?
I'm the man who left her there. Of course it is.
You're a decent enough lad at heart. Truly, you might redeem yourself yet.
On the morrow, by keeping his hood muffled around his face, Nevin managed to avoid being recognized by any of the servants in the Boar's Dun. When he and Rega went up to the woman's hall, Nevin kept the cloak on and busied himself with unpacking Rega's herbs and implements. Isola was mercifully gone, and Rotha was occupied with Threga and one of the pages.
"What do you mean you don't know where Marek is?" Rotha said to the page. "I told him to be here when the herdman came."
"He's scared, my lady, but I can look for him. It's going to take a long time."
"Then run and start right now."
As soon as the page was gone, Nevin took off his cloak and tossed it onto the floor. Rotha stared, her eyes filling with tears.
"Gaurian! Oh, thank the holy gods! It gladdens my heart to see you well."
"My humble thanks, my lady, but my name is no one."
"I know all about your father's spite. You've got to be gone when my son rides home."
"I had to come. I'll beg you for news of my Bronwyn."
Rotha's face went slack as she looked away.
"Oh, poor little Gwenny. I wish the gods had allowed her to marry you. I swear, maybe she should have ridden into exile with you."
She glanced Threga's way.
"Here, good sir. I can trust you for bringing my prince, if nothing else, so I'll speak freely. Blaine rode down to the Falcon not long ago, and he came home in a rage. He's sure Gwenny will never have him, he said. She walks around like she's half dead and barely speaks. I tried to get her to come here, but she refused. She's still mourning you in her heart, my prince, or so I hope."
"So we all may hope," Threga said dryly. "How often has Geraint ridden here to see his betrothed?"
As startled as a cornered deer, Rotha glanced this way and that.
"It's all nonsense," she burst out. "I won't believe that they do such a thing. Not Gwenny, not Gero. Blaine and Isola are just working themselves up with silly suspicions because they're so disappointed and eager. I won't believe it."
"What?"
Threga said.
"Tell me, my lady. Get these dark fears out of your heart."
Rotha hesitated, fighting with herself, then gave in.
"All the servants at the Falcon say that only Bronwyn stands between them and Lord Geraint's rage, just as if she were his wife. And Isola, my own child, has been working her brother up like a little scorpion. Gero was always so fond of Gwenny, she says. It's not fair. Gwenny even has the man I want. It's Gwenny this and Gwenny that, and all because poor Isola's always envied little Bronwyn's wretched beauty."
"Wretched indeed. You say you can't believe it. Is that true? Or do you only want to turn away from an unclean thing? Ye gods, I couldn't blame you."
Rotha broke and wept, covering her face with her hands.
"He's always loved her too much. Why do you think I worked so hard on Lord Dwen to let Gwenny marry so young? She had to get out of that cursed household."
"Cursed indeed. Twice cursed."
Nevin paced restlessly back and forth while Threga helped the lady into her chair.
"Tell me summat, my lady," Nevin said. "If I steal her away from her brother, will you blame me?"
"Never. But if you do, Geraint will call on his friends and they'll hunt you down like the grey deer."
"I'd die for her. I'm more clever than the grey deer."
That very evening, Nevin took his bay gelding and headed south for the Falcon's Dun. He was going to have to be clever. He could never risk riding straight into the fort, even if Geraint were gone. He would be of no use to Bronwyn if Geraint returned and killed him at her feet. Though Gaurian had never been particularly good with a sword, Nevin had a few tricks of Dweomer at his disposal. He was sure that if he could only get a few minutes alone with Bronwyn, he could easily convince her to steal out of the dun and escape with him. Once they were on the road, Geraint would never find them. When Nevin reached Ina's hut, he told her that Threga had sent him to keep an eye on things. As he'd hoped, Ina was so glad of it that she offered him shelter with her.
"Here, the women down in the village are starting to whisper that Bronwyn's carrying a bastard."
"Are they? Well, that betrothed of hers swore he'd come back for her, you see. Threga says to tell you that he's been seen sneaking around this part of the country."
When Ina raised her eyebrows and smiled, Nevin was sure that this delicious gossip would soon be all over the village. He could only hope it would give the truth no room to spread. For 3 days, Nevin kept a close watch on the Falcon Dun. Down at the edge of the forest, close to the road, he found a large spreading oak. By climbing up into the crown, he could lie hidden and see the fort, just a mile away across the meadowland. Drawing on all his will, he sent his thoughts across and tried to reach Bronwyn's mind, calling her, planting the thought that she should come out to the forest. Once he felt that he reached her. He also felt her brush the irrational thought aside. He kept trying, begging her, but failing, until he was desperate enough to consider sneaking into the dun the next time Geraint rode out to hunt. On the fourth afternoon, as he was lying on his perch, Nevin saw a man and a page riding slowly up the hill to the dun. He recognized the horse and the set of the rider's shoulders, Blaine. He climbed down and ran for the hut.
"Ina, for the love of every god, I need your aid. Can you give me an excuse to get into the Falcon Dun? A message I can deliver? Anything to tell the servants?"
"Well..."
Ina thought for a maddeningly long time.
"Here, I made a love filter up for Luther, Bronwyn's serving lass. She's got her eyes set on a lad in the village. You can fetch it to her."
While Ina got the packet of herbs, Nevin rubbed dirt into his hair and face. A poor disguise, but then no one had ever seen the prince the least bit dirty. He muffled himself up in his cloak, then galloped up to the dun. As he led his horse into the ward, he saw Blaine's page leading the lord's horses to the stables. Brithu came running and looked Nevin over coldly.
"And just what do you want?"
"A word with Luther, if you please. Ina gave me summat to fetch to her."
"I'll go ask her. You wait here and don't try to come in."
When Luther appeared, she looked the unkempt stranger over nervously.
"I brought you some herbs from Ina. She said you might give a poor man a drop of ale, too."
At the sound of his voice, Luther started, laying her hand at her throat.
"My prince," she whispered. "Thanks be to the goddess herself."
Then she raised her voice.
"Well, I will do that, because you've spared me a long hot walk to her hut."
Nevin tied his horse up by the door, then followed Luther inside to the servant's hearth in the great hall. He sat down in the straw in the curve of the wall, out of the way of the other servants, who were busy preparing dinner. They gave him hardly a look. Luther had the privilege of being generous to a stranger if she chose. Down at the far side of the hall, Geraint and Blaine were drinking at the honour table. From his distance, and because they talked in low voices, Nevin couldn't hear their words. But it was plain enough that Blaine was furious from the way he leaned forward in his chair and clutched his tankard like a weapon. When Blaine's page returned, he gave his master an anxious glance and sat down by his feet in the straw. Luther brought Nevin his ale and knelt down beside him with a nervous look at the lords.
"Where's your lady?"
Nevin whispered.
"Hiding from Lord Blaine. But she'll have to come out sooner or later, or Lord Geraint will take it amiss."
"No doubt. Oh, no doubt."
Luther winced and began to tremble.
"I know the truth," Nevin said. "I don't care. I've come to take her away."
Luther wept in two thin, silent trails of tears.
"I'll help if I can, but I don't know what good can ever happen now."
On the pretense of keeping out of the cook's way, Nevin moved from the hearth to a spot nearer the two lords. At last, Bronwyn slipped into the hall, pressing against the wall and watching her brother. Nevin was shocked at the change in her. Her cheeks were hollow and pale, her eyes deep-shadowed, and her stance that of a doe poised for flight. She glanced his way and allowed herself a tremulous smile. Nevin rose slowly, fighting with himself to keep from rushing to her side. Then Bronwyn shrank back against the wall. Nevin had forgotten Blaine and Geraint, who were leaning forward in their chairs and staring each other down. Slowly and deliberately Blaine rose, his hand on his sword hilt.
"May the gods curse you,"
Blaine said.
"It's true, isn't it?"
Geraint rose to face him, his hands on his hips, and he smiled in a calm way that made Nevin's blood run cold.
"Answer me," Blaine said, his voice ringing in the hall. "You've taken your sister to bed, haven't you?"
Geraint drew, the sword flashing, swung and struck before Blaine could get his blade half out of the scabbard. Bronwyn screamed, one high note, as Blaine took one step and staggered, the bright blood pouring down his chest. He looked at Geraint as if he were bewildered, then crumpled at Geraint's feet. His page began inching for the door. Geraint turned and went for him.
"Gero!"
Bronwyn rushed in between.
"Not the lad!"
Geraint hesitated, and that moment gave the page his life. He dashed outside without looking back. Just as Nevin ran forward, the boy grabbed the bay gelding and swung himself into the saddle. Screaming and weeping, the servants rushed for the door. The bloody sword still in his hand, Geraint began to laugh, then saw Blaine's body on the floor and came to himself. Nevin could see the reason return to his eyes as he fell to his knees and started keening. Nevin grabbed Bronwyn by the arm.
"We've got to get out now."
"I can't."
Bronwyn gave him a smile as mad as her brothers.
"I swore I'd die with him."
"No god or man would hold you to such an unclean oath."
"I hold myself to it, my prince."
Nevin grabbed her and started pulling her toward the door, but Geraint leapt up and ran to block it, his sword at the ready.
"Here's where I die," Nevin thought.
"Prince Gowrion, by the gods,"
Geraint hissed.
"I am. Go on, add my blood to your sworn friends."
"Not him, Gero," Bronwyn burst out. "Just kill me and be done with it."
"I won't raise my sword against either of you. My prince, will you take her away?"
"Gero,"
Bronwyn stared at him in disbelief.
"You promised me. You swore you'd kill us both."
Geraint's eyes snapped in fury. He grabbed her by the shoulder and shoved her into Nevin's arms.
"You little bitch, get out of here. I've slain the only man in the world I loved, and all over you."
Geraint slapped her across the face.
"The sight of you sickens me. This means the death of the Falcon, and it's all because of you."
The lie was so perfect that Nevin believed him. But when Bronwyn fell weeping against him, he saw the truth in Geraint's eyes. A real love, not mere lust, the hopeless ache of a man sending away the only thing he ever loved.
"Take the grey from the stable," Geraint said. "It would have been yours in the dowry."
Geraint turned and threw his sword across the great hall, then flung himself down by Blaine's body. Slowly, one step at a time, Nevin half-carried, half-dragged Bronwyn out of the hall. He looked back once to see Geraint cuddled against Blaine's back. Just as when a warrior lies beside his slain friend on the battlefield and refuses to believe him dead, no matter how many men try to get him to come away. Out in the ward, the last of the sunset flared through shadows. Torch in hand, Brithu led the grey out of the stables. Luther rushed from the brock with a pair of saddlebags and some rolled-up blankets. An eerie silence hung over the deserted ward.
"My prince, forgive me," Brithu said. "I didn't recognize you."
"I'm blasted glad you didn't."
"Luther, is there anyone else left in the dun? You'd all better flee to your families. The boar will ride back as soon as ever it can, and they'll fire the place for Blaine's sake."
"Then we'll leave straight away, my prince. Here, I've brought food and such like for my lady."
Nevin lifted Bronwyn into the saddle like a child, then mounted behind her. He rode out slowly, letting the burdened horse pick its own pace. At the bottom of the hill, Nevin glanced back for a last look at the dun, rising dark against the sunset sky. With the Dwayoma sight, it seemed to him that he saw flames already dancing. That night, they rode only for a few hours, until they were well away from the dun and into the safe hills. Nevin found a copse of trees beside a stream for their camp. After he tended the horse, he built a little fire out of twigs and scraps of dead wood. Bronwyn stared at the fire and never spoke until he was done.
"You must know," she said.
"I do. I want you, child and all."
"Let me spare you that. I want to die. You can't still love me. I'm carrying my own brother's bastard."
"That's my shame as much as yours. I left you there alone with him."
"You didn't push me into his bed."
Bronwyn gave him an uncertain smile, a pathetic attempt to be cold.
"I don't love you anymore, anyway."
You don't lie as well as your brother.
Bronwyn sighed and looked at the fire. There'll be a curse on the child. I just know it. Why won't you just kill me? Garrow promised me he'd kill us both, and here he was lying to me the whole time. He promised